is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, welcome again, one and all, to the Grillion Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with the boys in the bunker, broadcasting from the Mohorovicic discontinuity, literally hundreds of miles down in the underground. Glad to be here with you as always. Chris Hayes, our producer and co-host, joins us. Chris, how are you this evening?
I'm well. I'm a little sick. I'm trying to get over this business.
I was about to say, I might dispute your wellness, sir.
I think I'm coming down with the old lockjaw.
Well, better that than scurvy, I suppose. And Caleb, on the other hand, in terms of landlubbers, is doing quite well. But then again, you can't really get any closer to the ground than below ground. Caleb, how are you tonight in this Hollow Earth Eve?
I'm better than Chris is, and that's only because I don't touch the hadles with my bare hands.
That's right, exactly. We all know that potatoes have a strong likelihood of breeding bacteria, Chris.
Well, Caleb's just a racist. He's a racist.
That's right.
He doesn't like potatoes.
We don't discriminate against Hollow Earth Hadal residents or anything along those lines. Boy, I tell you, so much going on in the news today. I finally got to take a little bit of time off over the weekend. Such a nice thing to do. I don't very often take off, you know, time from work. But I did this weekend, and I went out to visit the Biltmore House. And of course, also to catch up on culinary delights and the like. And then back to it this morning, and boy, I tell you, the whole world just seems to be blowing up. A lot of weirdness happening out there, and something I want to touch on a little later in the program. There's been this really strange story about pets going missing in Texas. Now, a lot of people probably laugh and think, okay, you know. But in truth, it seems very strange. When you have in a particularly small locality, a particular residential area, and over the course of a couple of months, 40 pets, some of them large dogs, just go missing off the face of the earth. Some people may not see that as a mystery. There's probably a prosaic explanation. But as I've said many times in the past, you know, pets and animals aren't the only things that go missing. At any given time, there's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 80,000 different open cases involving missing persons in the United States alone. And one that I revisited recently was that of Zeb Quinn. You guys remember Zeb Quinn, who went missing right here in Asheville?
Yeah, that was years ago, like when I was in middle school.
Yeah, I mean, that was a long time ago.
What was that, 1999, 2000?
No, early 2000s. You know, and folks at home, if you want to check this out, there's a Wikipedia page about Zeb Quinn's disappearance. Zeb went missing. The circumstances involving that case were pretty strange. Zeb, the story, to be very brief here, had to do with the fact that he was looking to buy a car. He'd been with a friend that night and decided that he wanted to go and take a look at this vehicle. Suddenly, he got a page. That should date the story for you somewhat. He got a page and suddenly was very frantic and said, "I have to get out of here." Now, some reports read that the friend whom he'd been with actually said that Zeb Quinn was in such a hurry to get away when he got this page that he literally rear-ended his friend's car, took off, and left. The incident was not reported, but it was alleged that the same car that was damaged when Zeb Quinn was in a hurry to leave later that night was also involved in an accident. Okay, Zeb Quinn was never seen again after this, of course, this last run-in with his friend, although there was one report that he may have appeared at a gas station somewhere on Hendersonville Road. Days after he went missing, a phone call was made to his employer saying that he wouldn't be able to be at work, and it was later determined that the same friend whose car was rear-ended had actually made that call and admitted to having done so. Now, the vehicle that Zeb Quinn had been driving at the time that he went missing was found in the Little Pigs Barbecue parking lot. Yeah.
But God, that's so close to home. I know it's my hometown, but geez, that's...
Isn't that? Yeah. Well, see, that's
physically close to my home.
Folks at home, I want you to think, you know, I mean, it's easy to disassociate when you've got, okay, story of a missing person case. But, you know, we've covered the Dennis Lloyd Martin disappearance, which I was telling my friend Hannah over the weekend about. And I tell you, it is an absolutely chilling case. And when we talk about these cases that are so close to home, Dennis Lloyd Martin, revisiting that myself over the weekend, there are times where I'm sitting and I'm talking about this and to somebody and I'm thinking, whoa, you know, my gosh, this happened literally 2.5 hours from where I'm sitting right now. Zeb Quinn went missing as though he dropped off the face of planet Earth and was never found again. And that happened literally 15 minutes from where we're sitting right now. When his car was found, the vehicle was parked in the Little Pids parking lot. A large pair of lips had been drawn in lipstick on the back window. There were bottles that were found in the back seat of the car, along with a small Labrador puppy and a jacket that didn't belong to him. The front driver's seat had been moved forward as though someone smaller than him had been driving the car. And they were able, of course, utilizing forensic science to determine that there were fibers and other things in the coat that led them to a couple of suspects. People were questioned, but there was no such conclusive lead that led to any strong indication of some person's involvement. While foul play is suspected, there are no credible leads in terms of who it may have been, and the Asheville Police Department still maintains, you know, we don't know exactly who this was, what happened, who was involved. We know that this man went missing, and we suspect foul play, and we think that probably the answer to the case is yet to be determined because we have yet to find a person who knows something. And we eventually think that they'll come forward, but until that time, we're waiting for that person to come forward. But we do believe, however, according to the police, in numerous statements over the years, that we're waiting for someone who has that information to do just that, to come forward, step forward, and provide information. And we take for granted sometimes these missing person cases. And these disappearances really are strange. They've kind of become a running theme here on this program. I've met David Pilates. Someone I've never spoken to, however, about this is Butch Witkowski. He was actually very influential for Pilates at the time. He was authoring the Missing 411 books. And Butch Witkowski is going to join us in the second hour. Of course, he has been a UFO investigator. He's researched a lot of paranormal kinds of things, including not just missing person cases, but human mutilations as well. And so in hour two, we're going to be talking with Butch about this, and this is going to be a fabulous, fabulous discussion, no doubt. But here's what's going on in the news. Before we get to all of that in hour two, right now, there have been a lot of discoveries in the news, and I think that as technology improves, and of course, as we're learning more and more about things that we have observed but not understand or understood entirely for decades, if not for centuries, the universe is getting smaller and smaller. Right now, scientists are abuzz about what have been called weird X-ray signals, for example, that have been detected from deep space. Some think they could be a sign of dark matter, the invisible substance making up about 85% of all the matter in the universe. Race Hobbs back in Master Control, not the dark matter you may be thinking of at this time. Different dark matter. Now, Scientific American reports the anomalous X-rays spotted by the European Space Agency's orbiting XMM Newton telescope originate from two different sources, the Andromeda Galaxy and the Perseus cluster of galaxies. The challenge is to determine what created those X-rays as described in a study published last month in the Physical Review Letters. Now, the signal is real, but it is weak, and astronomers now are attempting to try and determine whether it is extraordinary or if it has some sort of a mundane explanation. Now, in a lot of cases, it seems every week we're talking about some weird signal from space. We don't know exactly the explanation or the source behind a lot of these. And it is likely that it is entirely natural. And if it can be determined conclusively what this is, then scientists, of course, can attempt to try and identify what or if dark matter is in any way connected or responsible. Now, according to a quote from astrophysicist Kevork Abzijan of the University of California in Irvine, if the X-ray emission line is conclusively shown to be due to dark matter, the implications are, of course, profound. If this observation sounds familiar, Scientific American reported, it's because researchers using NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope detected anomalous gamma rays near Milky Way's center earlier. Probably would have been well before that. But some think that these actually may be evidences of dark matter particles colliding and annihilating each other. Now, the difference between the Fermi and the XMM Newton observations more recently in this energy of the light involved has been connected to the masses of hypothetical dark matter particles that could have created them. Fermi's gamma rays are more than a million times more energetic than the X-rays, of course, and therefore the particles that created the former would have to have been more massive than a proton. So I guess while we continue to look at this and see what may be happening here, some people are... I mean, there are a lot of different things on the table in terms of what we may be seeing here. There's been discussion of sterile neutrinos, X-ray photons, X-ray light, all kinds of things. We'll see what happens. But we'll, of course, keep our eyes peeled because I think that, again, maybe in likelihood, we're looking at something mundane. But if we end up proving that dark matter is a component here, it's not only going to, of course, verify a lot of expectations we've had about the universe for a long time, but it's also going to make us look differently even at our expectations about dark matter, because one of the big things about this story and one of the key elements here is the fact that this invisible substance believed to make up about 85% of all matter in the universe, well, if we actually are able to determine that whatever these anomalous X-rays are emanate from dark matter, it may change certain ideas that we have about dark matter and, of course, the way that we will attempt to detect it in the future. The more we learn, the more we'll be able to see. The more we can see in the future, the more, well, we'll be able to find it more quickly. And I think probably as we do so, it's going to change a lot of those past expectations about the nature of the universe and how it works. On that same line of thought, by the way, you know, as Comet Lovejoy leaves Earth's, well, at very least near Earth, near enough to be able to be seen, it's going to be another 8,000 years before we see Lovejoy again.
Yeah, we'll just catch it next time.
Yeah, catch you on the flip side, Lovejoy. But as we're waiting for Lovejoy to come back around, here it is, only a week, less than a week, in fact, and now asteroid. Which one is it? Is it 2004 BL86, I believe? Yeah, it's going to be within 745,000 miles of Earth. You were telling me, Chris, that we're supposed to be able to see this asteroid with a telescope or even maybe with binoculars.
Yep, with just a normal run-of-the-mill, not crazy high-powered telescope or a good set of binoculars. Yeah, you should be able to see it.
That's incredible. And I was wondering about this. I thought, you know, how are we going to see an asteroid with binoculars? And BBC News reported on this earlier this week, and they had actually pointed out that the best chance for viewing this will be from 8 p.m. tonight, which is going to be within an hour of this moment right now for live listeners, and 1 a.m. on Tuesday. So we've got a little bit of a well, actually, it's not a large margin of time.
5-hour window.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's overcast here in Asheville, so we won't be able to see it, but I hope maybe some of you guys out there will be nonetheless. Now, asteroid 2004 BL86 is apparently very large, and it's believed that this thing may brighten enough, again, that it's going to be able to be visible, but nonetheless will not be observable with the naked eye. Some astronomy websites say a pair of binoculars could do the trick, but Sky and Telescope magazine recommends at least a 3 or 4 inch diameter telescope. In other words, here at the bunker, we're equipped to do it, but, well, damned if we can get around those storm clouds, huh? Oh, boy. Unfortunately, our friends up north probably are going to have the same problem with this nor'easter that's blowing in there and slowing air traffic and all kinds of other things just as well. Now, one good technique, they say, for fast movers like 2004, is to identify and lock onto a star along its path. This was according to senior editor Kelly Beatty of Sky and Telescope. Then just watch at that time, and the asteroid is predicted to pass by that particular star. What you probably would expect to see would be something that would be slightly similar to a shooting star, a little less, less bright than a shooting star, obviously, because what we're talking about here is reflectivity rather than being something that's physically burning, I guess, as it's passing along. And, of course, NASA scientists are saying that they're going to snap radar-generated images using the Deep Space Network antenna at Goldstone, California, as well as the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. Arecibo. That is 2 weeks in a row that we've had Arecibo in the news, because last week we were talking about, of course, detecting signals from outer space. Arecibo in Puerto Rico being probably most famous of all satellite dishes associated with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And apparently humankind hasn't quite yet adopted the cojones to engage itself in active SETI or METI, in which we are actually broadcasting signals out into deep space. But maybe we don't have to, because the big news this week, guys, and this is going to be a theme throughout this first hour, before we get Butch Witkowski on during hour two and get into the real deep and sometimes dark history of missing person cases with him, really looking forward to that. Even though it's a dark subject, it's one that has compelled and interested me for a long time. But first, we're going to look at a lot of, frankly, what I think we can effectively term BS in the media. I have heard for days now so much about the newly released Project Blue Book files. Chris and I touched on this on Graylian X. Newly released. Race is back in Master Control. Race, are you in there, buddy?
Yeah, I'm actually here. I've got to turn off the studio monitors in the background, but yeah, I'm here.
Listen,
sorry,
Race,
about that, Mike.
No, that's okay, because as a longtime UFO researcher yourself, I've just got to ask you, what do you think about this? We're just growing in leaps and bounds here. We have now finally uncovered the Air Force's Project Blue Book files. This is a real step in the right direction, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's a step in the right direction as far as searchability and accessibility and simplicity. But the documents themselves have been on the web for a long time already.
What?
And, I feel sorry for our good friend, Micah. I really do, because he has taken some really bad rap, and it wasn't his fault. It was simply bad journalism out there beyond his scope. So
now you're talking about John Greenwald.
Absolutely, yeah, the Black Vault, yeah. And my hat's off to him, though. What a wonderful job he's done in creating a website that has searchable PDF formatted documents for us to go get.
Absolutely.
He does it all for free, and my hat's off to him. He does a really good job.
That's right. I don't hold John. You know, I've met John very briefly, and I followed the Black Vault for a long time. And you're absolutely right, Jim. Jim Race. You know, one of those names. You're absolutely right. I don't look at him and say it's his fault. The media has done a terrible job pointing out the fact that these Blue Book files have been available online for years.
Very true. Very true.
Chris and I pointed this out on the Graylian X podcast earlier this week, which subscribers have already heard. I think bluebookarchive.org was one of the websites that carried these. IO9 did actually point out that these files have been available for quite some time. But, I mean, I've even seen the New York Daily News. I've seen the BBC reporting on this. It's a double-edged sword because, first of all, John Greenwald has been getting a lot of attention with the Black Vault. That's good. I think that the UFO subject on the whole has been getting a lot of attention. When we've got the BBC, you know, reporting on the Air Force's involvement and, of course, the fact that there have been documents that have been withheld from the public and then later subsequently released, when that is being brought to public attention, you know, UFO researchers will say, oh, we've known that for years. Come on. Steve Bassett last week on the program would have said, you know, that's not news. That's nothing new. But, you know, it is in the sense that there are people who today had been previously unaware of that. When people take it...
Absolutely. That's a good point, Micah, because I have seen at least a dozen articles online of local news stations picking up this story, going and journalists actually going there and finding UFO reports in Blue Book files from their hometown and doing stories on it. So it has generated a lot of talk and steered a lot of people to those documents that didn't previously know they were even there.
I think it's wonderful that there's so much attention being drawn to the subject on the whole, on the same token, or by the same token, I think that the fact that the media can't seem to get the facts on this, and furthermore that they've played the subject down, nonetheless, a lot of, you know, the New York Daily News, Chris and I were just having a ball looking at the way that the New York Daily News reported on this the other day, because they had been talking about the fact that these Blue Book files seem to point to things like pie pans being tossed from the tops of buildings and weather balloons as the explanation behind a lot of these UFO reports. Now, I want to touch on something from BBC Magazine that appeared, the date was January 25th. Okay, so this is news, or the newest news, at least as of yesterday. They point out five key points that they think people should know about these more than 100,000 pages that John has added to the Black Vault website. And for those who'd like to actually see this, it is theblackvault.com. That's John's website. And, of course, longtime UFO researchers and those with interest in the subject will have probably visited the site many times. But the key points that BBC Magazine puts forward I find to be good, and this is maybe one of the fairest treatments that we've seen of this subject, apart from what Chris Hayes and I said previously. And they are as follows. One, Project Blue Book had a sizable mission. They talk about, of course, and they actually, yet again, calling attention to people who I think deserve it. Alejandro Rojas, our friends at Open Minds, are mentioned a couple of times in this article. That's very good. And they talk about not just Roswell, but a lot of these kinds of rather high-profile incidents that were reported in that day. The Socorro sighting is mentioned just as well. But number two, they say Project Blue Book was created in a time of public unease. They say there was a lot of hysteria with the public, and that, to the military and government at the time, was a big threat in itself, according to John Greenwald. It didn't matter if UFOs were alien or not, they were causing a panic, and so the government had to settle everybody's nerves. Number three, in this BBC magazine article, they point out that many of the Project Blue Book cases appear open and shut. Now, that's where I started getting worried as I was reading this article sequentially, because it seemed at that point that this article was going in the same direction as the New York Daily News piece. They say that though many credible sources from Navy admirals to military and civilian pilots reported seeing UFOs, most of the cases investigated by Project Blue Book were deemed caused by weather balloons, swamp gases, meteorological events, or other temperature inversions. That is true, but that is not the case for all of them. And then we get to number four. Some Project Blue Book cases aren't so easily explained. I want to spend a little bit of time on this, like the New York Daily News and other agencies did not do. According to Greenwald and Rojas, more than 700 Project Blue Book entries could not ultimately be explained by investigators. Many such cases cited insufficient data or evidence, but even some of the closed cases raise more questions than answers for UFO researchers. And one such example, again, we come back to Socorro, New Mexico, 1964, in which case a police officer halted vehicular pursuit of a suspect after he saw a strange aircraft overhead. The officer followed the craft, this is widely known in UFO circles, which he described as bearing a strange red insignia, and saw it land and two child-sized beings exited the craft. It later took off, leaving scorch marks and trace evidence on the ground. Project Blue Book labeled it unexplained. Even after all these decades, they still can't explain it, Greenwald says. And then finally, the fifth point they make here, there's still information to be uncovered about UFO activity. Though Greenwald has amassed a stockpile of government documents, he says there are still many he and the public have not accessed. One request to the National Security Agency yielded hundreds of pages, but they were so redacted that only a few words were readable on each page. Other U.S. government entities, and actually, before I continue, I want to point out, by the way, that, you know, about those redactions, you know, I've talked with Stanton Friedman about this at least on three occasions. There have been a lot of people in UFO circles who have, you know, really complained about the fact that, you know, even though there's been information that's been released by the government, the number of redactions present in those documents released almost make it impossible to read and obtain any information from this. But, you know, rather than simply looking at ufological literature, I try to maintain a balance. And a lot of people, I think, on both sides really dislike me for doing that, which includes certain former KGRA radio hosts who publicly take issue with this kind of thing on their blogs and name people like Stephen Bassett, Richard Dolan, and me. Which, by the way, I should just point out, I support fully. And to individuals who you know, would like to take personal and name me in their criticisms and attacks like that, while I sometimes worry about people who are contributing only in criticizing others rather than writing books, articles, and trying to do what John Greenwald has done with uncovering information, I still support what you do, because I support your right to freedom of speech. And of course, I think that also you criticizing me or Richard Dolan or anybody else on this network or anywhere in this community is conducive to helping us sharpen our argument and helping us better ourselves as researchers. So God bless you for your write-ups and for your criticisms. Whether good or bad, I think they all help. And we have to be critical of this phenomenon as well as critical of each other. But that said, if we look at, for instance, the writing of Carl Sagan in the demon-haunted world, he, I think, gives a good explanation for why there are a lot of redactions that occur from time to time in these government documents. And one simple reason is, of course, that with these agencies, especially the FBI, CIA, and the like, if it has to do with government employees, persons living or dead, or relatives of those individuals, and if information released may compromise the privacy of those entities, individuals, agencies, and the like, there are going to be redactions, and that's probably the reason for a lot of this. But the article continues, other U.S. government entities, including the Central Intelligence Agency and Defense Intelligence Agency, also conducted UFO investigations that have not publicly been released, according to Greenwald. His final statement, I think Project Blue Book is simply the tip of the iceberg, adding he will continue to request more information from the U.S. government. There are secrets after conspiracies, after scandals that continue to come out. There's always something to go after. And I think that that's the fundamental truth that we should all remember here. There is always something to go after, whether that be an individual, whether that be a document. There is always something to go after. But one thing I think we all agree on is that if we keep asking the right questions, we in the research community, whether it be Rich Dolan, Stephen Bassett, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, or Micah Hanks, whoever, if we ask the right questions, we won't just see another 50 years of stagnation. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this. Dark heart of Appalachia. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. As we broadcast on a relatively chilly evening here in the heart of the Hollow Earth, where we focus on all things happening in the news, but a bit of interest just as well. Hola to my vato out there, Red Pill Junkie in the chat room, along with ex-lady. I believe Mr. Malliard's there. I think who we're going to be, of course, sending out howdy hellos and hearty welcomes to as he joins us here, part of the fold on the KGRA. Speaking of part of the fold, be sure and check out our good buddy Rich Dolan right after this, tonight on the KGRA. And as we're getting back to things, you know, the thing that's been on my mind, well, one of them, over the last few days is ESP, the reach of the mind. What are we capable of? You know, I was just thinking about Ryan Sprague earlier today. I see him in the chat room, too. Maybe Ryan has ESP. Maybe he is actually capable of precognition. You know, Chris, you being maybe one of the most skeptical of us here present, have you ever experienced what you would call an extrasensory experience?
Not live, no.
Not live?
I mean, I guess if you want something like extreme deja vu on a level that is way beyond what anyone would consider deja vu, like retroactive clairvoyance, then...
So you don't think you're psychic?
No, not at all.
Hmm. Caleb?
I don't think I'm psychic, but I'm pretty sure I was creeping out the lady at the grocery store earlier.
Oh, yeah? By reading her mind?
No, I just have a really weird face.
I see. Okay, well... You guys have helped a lot. I, on the other hand, knew that that would be the case because I am psychic.
So why even ask?
Well, just for pure entertainment. I like to be able to prove to myself that I'm right from time to time. No, I'm just kidding. The truth here is that while I think that, of course, we can continue to dispute scientifically whether there is a phenomena that we would collectively call extrasensory perception, what we cannot deny is that there are a lot of varied opinions about it and the legitimacy behind actual ESP research. And something that really came to mind for me recently that was both troubling as well as revealing had been the fact that there was an article. You know, Jim Harold and I just kind of offhandedly decided to touch on this, on the new audio podcast we're doing for the Paranormal Report that he and I do together. And by the way, those of you who are not following that already, we've been doing videos for a long time. We're actually breaking down the video portion of that show into little smaller segments throughout the week, and we're doing an audio podcast in addition to that because so many of you out there I know like to listen to these shows while you're working. So we're trying to get to where the Paranormal Report is something that you can also listen to while working, but then those who have time to watch the videos can do that just as well. We touched on this story, and I swore at that time I wanted to get more in-depth into this on this week's program where I had the time to do so. There was this article that the Washington Post carried last week titled, "The Bizarre ESP Experiments Conducted on Aboriginal Children Without Parental Consent." I have so many problems with this article. So many. And I want to break them all down for you right now. Because I'm going to tell you something. This article, I found the headline interesting. What I found after I actually read the article was glaring media bias against alternative research. You know, Red Pill and I are always talking about Graham Hancock's great argument, his ongoing cause that he champions, which he calls the war on consciousness. I got to meet Graham back in October, and delightful guy, by the way, and he's right. There is a war on consciousness. And this article is a brilliant example of that. I want to break that all down for you right now. Let's start from the top. Canada's residential schools for Aboriginal children were places of hunger, isolation, and misery. Go ahead and just keep that in mind. I'm going to read that again so that I can emphasize that for you. Canada's residential schools, for Aboriginal children were places of hunger, isolation, and misery. Children as young as 3 were separated from their families and became wards of the state. True, by the way. And that is indeed an atrocity. That, as a matter of fact, is the primary atrocity. I want you to remember that there are children who are removed from their families and who essentially become wards of the state, which then subsequently decides to make decisions for those children on their behalf without parental consent. That's the problem here. Bear that in mind as I'm reading this for you. In the 1940s, the children were also, as more and more evidence is revealing, the unwitting subjects of bizarre, cruel, and unethical experimentation. Before I go any further, I want to give you an example of the kind of unethical experimentation we're talking about here. Despite the title of this article, "The Bizarre ESP Experiments Conducted on Aboriginal Children Without Parental Consent," ESP being extrasensory perception, there's a link embedded in those words, unethical experimentation. They link to an article that was carried by CBC.ca that dealt with ear experiments done on children. You actually click the link. You'll really like this. It takes you to a page at the CBC.ca website that says, "Sorry, we can't find the page that you requested," but the slug on the link comes up and it actually reads, "Ear experiments done on kids at Kenora Residential School." Doesn't sound like ESP research to me, but I digress. Not really. A recently uncovered experiment reveals the depths of the access given to so-called researchers seeking to find evidence that Aboriginal children, by dint of their race, had extrasensory perception, also known as ESP or a sixth sense. In other words, because these children were indigenous people, it was a belief maybe at the time that some of them maybe had a propensity toward extrasensory perception.
And hence, obviously, they raise the question about racism. And in truth, obviously, I think there is a component here that deals with that. And that's something that we have to bear in mind. I think most people who would read this with a conscience would. But I don't think that maybe that's the greater scope that we're addressing here. Now, carrying along with this article, 50 children at the Indian Residential School in Brandon, Manitoba, became the subjects of a series of tests that sought to establish a new measure for identifying ESP and also to find evidence of supernatural abilities of primitive people. As was typical for the time, there was no parental consent, but the children ranging from ages 6 to 20 likely participated willingly, it puts in quotes, as the study claims, eager for candy that might stave off their persistent hunger. Now, this is where the article, where I start having problems, and I have numerous issues with this, but this is a quote directly from the Washington Post article. "The study was conducted for researchers at what was then known as the Duke Parapsychology Laboratory. The findings were published in the Journal of Parapsychology in 1943. Now, what that sounds like,
is that the study was carried out at the Duke Parapsychology Laboratory, and that is not the case. I think that we can look at that and we can say that based on the fact that they're talking about the study was conducted for researchers, that means that the study, which took place in Canada, was done for the greater body of research which was conducted at Duke in 1943 and throughout that period. But this article doesn't really do a great job indicating that that was the case. And it seems to connect the Duke University Parapsychology Lab directly with this. Now, to clarify that point, which is one of the big issues I have right here, there was an article that was featured at CBC News, and it reads as follows. One Winnipegger said he was shocked to stumble on a report that shows experiments were conducted on children at Brandon's Indian Residential School in the 1940s. This is incredible, especially when you take into account the other studies, medical tests that had been conducted at residential schools, and this according to Mangan Linklater. Linklater was reading Mysterious Manitoba by Chris Rutkowski, a friend of the program, friend of mine, when he saw a passing reference to experiments on extrasensory perception, or ESP, on students at the school that took place in 1941. A librarian friend found the actual scientific journal article and sent it to him. The article was published in 1943 by a scientist named A.A. Foster. A librarian friend found the actual scientific journal article and sent it to him. By the way, Foster, we should point out, who was present at... I should correct myself. He was not present during the experiments, but he was the author of the paper. He had also formerly worked with the Duke University Parapsychological Lab, at which time, of course, involved J.B. Ryan and other researchers who were famous in the history of psychic research. Now, the study was trying to find a better way to test ESP using special cards. The author of the study said that 50 children that participated did so willingly. It's not like these kids knew what they were participating in, because if these kids were starving already, a little bit of candy would go a long way, according to Linklater. He said the children weren't hurt in the experiment, which was conducted by a teacher named Miss Doyle, but were given candy and other favors if they participated. There's no parental consent, there's no research studies that would have been ethical by our standards today, and these kids were exploited, Linklater says in the CBC article. Other articles Linklater read on the Brandon School, including Shingwalk's Vision and a National Crime, described conditions there as deplorable with malnourished children. If you're starving and somebody says you want to participate in this study, we're going to give you some candy. You're 3 years old, you're from a Norway house, and you know you're in this school. I mean, what are you going to say? Linklater said. And that is true. That is important, because there were a lot of atrocities occurring here. There were a lot of problems in terms of things that children were being subjected to. The problem I have with this Washington Post article, of course, is the way that they tie in a lot of these, of course, obvious instances of malnourishment, mistreatment at these schools, with the broader history of ESP, which they refer to in quotes throughout the article when they say such things as research. And, of course, altogether painting ESP in a bad light. And furthermore, they in the way that they word that segment I mentioned earlier, the study was conducted for researchers at what was then known as Duke Parapsychology Laboratory. The findings were published in the Journal of Parapsychology in 1943. I think that could have been worded a little better, because it does tend to make it sound like what they're saying is that these studies were carried out at Duke University, which had actually confused me just as well. Jim Harold and I, as I mentioned, talked about this on our Paranormal Report podcast recently, and I'd gotten a letter in response to this from a Mr. Thomas Downey, who wrote, "I was horrified to hear your comments on Brandon Residential School. I'm not Aboriginal, but I'm from Brandon, Manitoba. I worked for 6 years for the Dakota Ojibwe Tribal Council. I worked with a great many people who were housed in residential schools, and to my disgust had cousins who actually worked at a residential school, who in my youth made jokes about the mistreatment of Indian children. These facilities did not house children who were wards of the state because they were orphaned. They were forcibly removed from their families, from reserves all over Manitoba and across Canada. These children were starved, beaten for using their first languages, and often sexually abused by their custodians. This chapter in Canadian history is one of the bleakest periods. The children mentioned in your article were given candy to perform for the researchers that you discussed. Candy to children who were underfed and starved. The researchers did not have authorization from the parents that in most cases existed. The government of Canada recently held a tribunal to hear the stories of Aboriginal people in an attempt to resolve the wrongs done to these people. And in the future, and this is where this letter gets, I don't know about nasty, but certainly accusatory. Then again, I'm used to that. In the future, I think you should do your research before you discuss a topic. You and your cohort did exactly what you accused newspapers of doing in their comments about Project Blue Book. If you don't have the facts or the understanding, maybe it is better to say nothing. I apologize for any typos, but your article angered me greatly. And when he says that, your article angered me greatly, I wondered if Mr. Downey had mistaken the Washington Post article that we were criticizing as being something that we had written. It was a little strange, the response. You and your cohort did exactly what you accused newspapers of doing in their comments about Project Blue Book, which we had also addressed. And what, of course, I had said, as we have talked about earlier on this show as well, is the way that the news has just run with this story about the way that the Blue Book files are now available on the web, when in fact they've been available for quite some time. This article with the Washington Post, again, seems to refer to these children as wards of the state for whom decisions were made without parental consent. And again, you know, Mr. Downey, albeit respectively, you know, accuses Jim Harold and I of glossing over that and not doing the research. But I think that, frankly, a little of that appears in the Washington Post article, does it not? And I wrote back saying that there appeared to be discrepancies between the CBC.ca article and the Washington Post article, which it had seemed to indicate had taken place at Duke University, which obviously wasn't the case. And in fact, I have the article pulled up from the Parapsychological Journal in question. They link that at the bottom of the CBC article titled ESP Tests with American Indian Children, a Comparison of Methods by A.A. Foster. Briefly, the abstract reads as follows. 50 children attending a government school for Plains Indians in Canada were given tests for ESP capacity by a white teacher. The primary aim was to compare the effectiveness of a new type of test as against a standard technique, screened touch matching, which has long been used in ESP research. As it turned out, the older technique, which utilized the ESP cards concealed from the subject's view by an opaque screen, gave significant results, while the new technique gave only chance scores. The significant results consisted of 250 runs through the ESP deck, 5 runs for each of the 50 subjects. The children averaged 5.39 hits per deck, whereas expectation is 5. This average is sufficient to give a critical ratio of 3.07. The odds are more than 700 to 1 that such a result would not occur by chance. The new type of test, while it was a failure as far as producing evidence for ESP is concerned, may be regarded as an experimental control since the conditions were essentially the same so far as precautions are concerned. The principal significance of the experiment lies in its constituting the only published report to date of ESP experiments conducted with Indians as subjects. Mr. Foster is the author of 2 earlier articles dealing with ESP, and at one time was on the staff of the Parapsychology Laboratory at Duke, which he left to engage in industrial war work in Toronto, Canada. Now, that's the abstract, and we can get more to the article, but it really, having read the entire thing myself, gives a pretty good rundown of what we're talking about here. Now, of course, what Mr. Downey had written to us to address and had been, you know, quite accusatory toward Jim and I in addressing had been the revelation of the kinds of atrocities that were occurring there at that school. I want to make a differentiation. Ryan, the Duke Parapsychology Lab, had not been mistreating children. That certainly is not the case. And what the author of this paper, Mr. A.A. Foster, actually points out is that it had been decided that he would not be present during the experiments. The experiments had actually been carried out by another individual, a Miss D. Doyle, a matron of a residential school for Plains Indian children, who wrote, "The tests were carried out on Plains Indians at the Indian residential school at Brandon, Manitoba, in an environment very different from their natural one. The Western Canadian Plains Indians lead much more primitive lives than Indians of the United States. The primary occupations on the reserves are fishing, hunting, and trapping, although a few in the southern sections farm in a modern manner. Many of the children had never known any other than the most primitive life and never had seen trains or motor cars. The original environment is not, however, similar in all cases. Of the 50 children tested, 13 came from what might be classified as primitive, 14 from semi-primitive, and 23 from relatively advanced homes." Now, obviously, of course, in retrospect, looking back at the 1940s, we view this today, and there are some obvious issues with terminology and other obvious issues. And in light of what has come has been forthcoming about the conditions in these schools, such as the one here in Brandon, Manitoba, those conditions obviously raise ethical considerations. The Washington Post, of course, throughout this article just goes on and on and on about the bizarre experiments. Frankly, they do little, in my opinion, again, to address the actual atrocities. And in tying in the ESP component, as we've already pointed out, they link with the term unethical experimentation to ear experiments that have been done at these children at the Kenora Residential School, a different school, by the way, from the Brandon, Manitoba school. They link to all this, and they kind of tie it all in together, and then it gets really juicy a little later on where they start quoting people and their opinions on psychic research. And this is the reason that I take issue with this, of course. At this point in this article, they say ESP and human behavioral phenomena that transcend the known physical laws of nature were once hot topics of scientific interest, but have fallen from favor. It's fallen into disuse due to the fact that there's just nothing there, Scientific American columnist Michael Shermer told Discovery.com. Parapsychology has been around for more than a century, yet there's no research protocol that generates useful working hypotheses for other labs to test and develop into a model and eventually a paradigm that becomes a field. It just isn't there. Now, when I saw this, I was thinking, well, you know, since they talk about the Duke University Parapsychological Lab, of course, today the modern counterpart for that, no longer a part of Duke University but still nearby, is the Rhine Center for Consciousness Studies, named after J.B. Rhine, who had been the director of the lab there at Duke in the 1940s. I see this quote from Michael Shermer, and I thought that's an interesting quote, especially in light of, and granted, we talked about his revelatory experience that he had on this program some time ago that involved a clock, or rather, I think it was a radio, actually, and it mysteriously began working again around the time of he and his wife and their marriage. And, you know, he talked about this and described it as an experience that might, you know, shake even one's skepticism, one so skeptical as Michael Shermer. Now, the article which quotes Shermer, which is mentioned here by the Washington Post, get this, you guys will love this, it dates back to June 2013. And I'd been wondering, again, why is there no quote from the Rhine Center about these kinds of experiments in the Washington Post article? Maybe some people would feel that since this experiment took place, although I don't think the Post necessarily made it clear that this was the case, I think some would argue that, well, you know, this experiment took place up there at the Brandon, Manitoba school, and so this has nothing to do with the Rhine Center. Well, the protocols for the experiment, the bizarre experiment, and what that actually entailed was cards being held that a researcher could see but that the children could not, and effectively the children were asked to try and predict what the symbol on the card that the researcher was holding, Mrs. Doyle, would be. That is what was done, and when they got it right, they were often given a piece of candy. You know, to call that a bizarre, unethical experiment, I don't know, in the grand scheme of things, if that is necessarily, accurate. Although, again, we cannot deny the kinds of atrocities that have come to light in more recent years and what had been happening at that school and in similar areas throughout that region. That's certainly the case. But they quote Michael Shermer from this 2013 article, and it's funny because literally three paragraphs into this article from 2013 at Discovery News, this is what is said of what happened to parapsychology. Quote, "It hasn't gone anywhere," said John Kruth, executive director of the Rhine Research Center in Durham, North Carolina. "It's just become disorganized, underfunded, and in the realm of traditional science, largely ignored. The Rhine is one of a handful of privately funded groups in the United States still doing active research into parapsychology, sometimes called psi phenomena. People have never stopped doing research in these areas," Kruth said, "but the skeptic community is strong and vocal, and they're much better at working the media." Kruth attributes much of the field's decline in the United States during the 1970s and 1980s to media-savvy debunkers such as James Randi. I should point out again that in the time that has passed since this article appeared in 2013, not only has Michael Shermer come forward with his own, maybe not life-changing, but at least a experience that, as he wrote about at his blog, I believe that was for the Scientific American blog, Michael Shermer has come forward with his own experience that he says described, that he described being, of course, a prominent skeptic as being one that would shake one's skepticism. That maybe didn't change his fundamental worldview, But then again, I think that despite being a leader in the skeptic movement, and a controversial one for a number of reasons I won't get into right now, nonetheless, Michael Shermer has often, in the past, been at least politely moderate about these issues. You know, having spoken with Phyllis and the folks at Fate Magazine and done interviews with them, having appeared on Jim Harrell's show. John Kruth, who's mentioned in this article, gave Caleb and I a tour at the Ryan Center just a couple of summers ago. We met John, and he's actually stayed in touch. I still hear from him from time to time via email, and they have a copy of one of my books in their laboratory library there at the lab. Interesting that that John Kruth, who actually works with the modern counterpart to the Duke Parapsychology Laboratory, was not quoted. I should say that by the same token, that there is a small laboratory devoted to the history of the Duke operations, in which there are actual apparatus that were utilized in the original Duke lab that are still maintained, not in use, but for historical purposes, and are on display there at the Ryan Center. Funny that they wouldn't quote John Kruth here, but that they will cherry-pick this quote from a 2013 article to grab this little excerpt from Michael Shermer, talking about how parapsychological research has fallen into disuse because there's simply nothing there. There's nothing there. To further the point that what was done to these children in Manitoba, Canada, was wrong and unethical. Probably in the grand scheme of things, among the more unsettling treatment that were incurred by those poor children up there, this parapsychological experiment was among the better instances of things that were carried out with those kids, and that doesn't justify not obtaining parental consent, as Mr. Downey, who wrote very angry with Jim Harrell and I about this, as he points out, there were often parents who could have been asked, but they weren't, and often these children weren't rightly wards of the state. So I think that maybe there are some issues with the reporting that the Washington Post carried. The CBC.ca article is what much better. They feature a video, including Mr. Linklater, who found this in Chris Rutkowski's book. The actual paper itself wasn't there, but there were mention of the psychic experiments that Chris talked about. And furthermore, you can actually read the paper, which I went and read just for purpose of clarification as to whether or not any of these experiments were carried out in the United States, which in my initial rebuttal to Mr. Downey, I had said it had been our impression that these experiments were carried out at Ryan Research Center. I did note, however, that there was a big difference, and the possibility existed that one of the two media outlets had gotten that information wrong. And I went on to say this should be easy to discern, however, as the original documents appear embedded within the article I've linked, that CBC.ca article. That's all over at GraylianReport.com, and in reading this more carefully, again, I feel that the Washington Post was not clear in pointing out that these experiments did not take place at this Brandon, Manitoba school by virtue of the fact that they tried to say that this was done for researchers at Duke Lab. In fact, there was a former Duke Parapsychology Lab worker who had been involved. He had actually written the paper. But these experiments did not take place there. Whether or not the Washington Post had intended to indicate that, that was the impression that they had been given, and I want to clear that up for those who do read this article. And Jim Harrell and I both wrote back to Mr. Downey about this, and Jim, of course, you know, wanted to address this point by point. A, he said, this is Jim Harrell, neither Micah nor I meant to or I feel did downplay the horrific nature of the treatment of these children, and as I recall, I used the term horrible in my description of the general treatment of the children. I'm a parent, and I would never condone the mistreatment of children today or in the past. B, we were actually saying that, according to the information from the article, which is what we were referring to, that the ESP experiments, while definitely having some ethical issues, were far less egregious, based on the information presented in the article, than other abuses that took place. We felt that the Washington Post took the opportunity to focus on the ESP researchers, where they should have been focusing on the worst offenses. And then finally, Jim also says, personally, I find the treatment of Native North Americans among the most horrific chapters in the history of both our countries and would never downplay it. We actually had people thanking us for pointing out this unfortunate chapter in North American history so more people would be aware of it. I understand your sensitivity to the situation, and again, I'm sorry if you misinterpreted our intent, but as you can see, we never meant to disrespect these children or downplay the way that they were mistreated. Thank you for your note, and best regards, Jim Harrell. Jim always words things so eloquently, and more so, in fact, I think, than he is often given credit for. And what he says there really hits the nail on the head for me. Yes, this is a sensitive issue. Yes, this is something that needs to be highlighted. Yes,
there are wrongs that could be righted with a proper retelling of history. The problem I have is the way that it was mixed in by the Washington Post with information, quotes cherry-picked from older articles, links to entirely unrelated studies, and used in a way that essentially downplays psychic research. That, to me, is a problem. That is an obvious problem. And yes, I think that that betrays a media bias. A media bias that is something that really needs to be taken into consideration in terms of the way that these kinds of stories can be used to dissuade the reader from thinking that there's legitimacy to psychic research.
So I find this very interesting that, again, it seems very obvious to me. And again, you know, I see some folks in the chat room that are a little upset with the idea of skepticism and skeptics in general. I would liken my skepticism to a person who says, okay, I am a Catholic. However, I find that there are a lot of hypocrisies within the church today. Or you could be a person who says, I am a Democrat. However, I disagree with the broader attitudes expressed by my elected officials in Congress. Republicans could say the same thing. It doesn't matter what part of a group you're a part of. If I here am going to talk about my skepticism, and I'd be interested in hearing Chris Hayes, also a paraskeptic, on your points about this, but if I'm going to call myself a skeptic, I don't any more identify with the skeptic movement than a person who would take issue with their political party or their greater religious institution. You know, you can be a Catholic, but you don't have to agree with what the Holy Church of Rome says. You could be a Republican, but you don't have to agree with what your elected officials say. You know, you could be a gardener, but you don't have to go down there and, you know, participate in every ag convention and agree with everything that all the people at the ag convention say that you should be doing as a gardener.
Absolutely. And I don't like identifying myself with groups anyway. It's like I used to say, you know, back when I was an angry young man and I was militant atheist, Chris. I realize the folly of my ways. I don't like being an ist.
Yeah.
Or an ick or an ism. I don't like that label. Like Neil deGrasse Tyson says, it's just,
yes,
I see things, and when I see proof of things, then they're there. But when someone tells me something, I'm not going to automatically jump in and believe it because someone said, I saw a flying saucer. Okay, that's cool. I don't doubt that you saw that, but I'm going to need some more information to go on if I'm going to join your club.
Yeah, absolutely. Caleb, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say one aspect about the modern view or how a quote-unquote skeptic is looked at anymore is I feel like it is people that don't really have an authority. Look, there's a ton of skeptics out there that are actually doing a hell of a lot of good for the scientific community, but I think there's a lot of people that pose as a quote-unquote skeptic because it is an easily attainable passage into authority. As soon as you go around starting to say that this is BS and this is why, because this is my opinion, a lot of people are going to be like, this guy seems like he knows what he's talking about because he has conviction. And I think that people don't really realize the responsibility that they have when they start espousing things as a quote-unquote skeptic. I think people tend to look at those people and think they're an authority for some reason.
Yeah, the only point that I would differ with you on is that I agree completely, except for the fact that it is not necessarily always opinion-based. Not that you said that.
Right, yeah.
But you know, again, I think that what the skeptic would base their perspectives on rather than opinion would be, look, consensus opinion and scientific knowledge does not account for this, and therefore, in likelihood, probability would dictate that it is impossible or simply non-existent. I like, Chris, also that you point out that, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson has said, look, I'm not a figurehead for the atheist movement. I'm not an ist. I'm someone who's just looking for answers. Many skeptics, I think, are doing that. And frankly, again, you know, I commend Michael Shermer for, since this Discovery News article in which he was quoted, cherry-picked because they didn't interview him for the Washington Post. They go back a year and a half and they grab an article. They take the select quote that they like from him and they overlook entirely what John Kruth said. If anyone was more relevant to this Washington Post article, it was John Kruth, a part of the continuation of the research that is actually referenced in the article. Again, I'd like to know why in the world there was never any quote whatsoever from John Kruth. Not even cherry-picked from the Discovery article like they did with Michael Shermer. Do you think that's bias? I think there are a lot of problems with that. Let's highlight the atrocities, but let's not target ESP research as being something that is unethical and qualifying as mistreatment of children. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this.
Is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time here on the Worldwide Global Radio Alliance, KGRARadio.com. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grillion Report. Now, changing gears a little bit, because in the last segment, we were certainly talking about something that I think is fairly hypocritical.
Crypto-hitical.
Crypto-hitical, yes, indeed. Or at very least, in Caleb's case, quotable, as we saw our friend Claudette Huber of UFO Daily Bread quoted Caleb there on Twitter in relation to that last discussion. And I want to point out very briefly, by the way, Caleb, when you were talking about opinion-based skepticism, you were actually citing the Health Ranger in relation to an article of skepticism that he espoused towards singularity, which you were right, that was entirely opinion-based, a little different from what we were talking about in terms of the skeptical movement, so I did want to point that out.
Right, yeah, I mean, he wrote an article called Debunking the Singularity, and his big question to it all was, where's the mechanism? What's the machine that we plug our USB ports, because we'll obviously be using those in the future? How do we plug our USB ports into our brains and upload ourselves? And it's like, well, maybe it's just not that simple.
Yeah, well, things are very seldom as simple as they seem. And that's the point, I think, that we, you know, must address when it comes to discussions like this or any similar discussion. Speaking of discussions, there's somebody who's going to be joining us here in mere moments. I've wanted to talk to this guy for a very long time. And you already know, if you've been listening to the duration of the program, who this is, Butch Witkowski, who's going to be our guest here in just a few moments. But as we bring him on, I do want to touch on this story that we teased at the top of the hour. What has been reported is that dozens of dogs in Wise County, Texas, have gone missing over the past 2 months, and law enforcement purportedly has no idea where these pets have gone. That'd be one thing if one or two pooches go missing, right? But when we have more than 40 dogs, I understand, that have gone missing since November in such a small area, people are really concerned about what's going on. They say it's been really difficult trying to explain what's happening here. Police are trying to come to terms with this, and of course, obviously, the owner of pets. And yet, as disturbing as something like this is, this may seem like something that would very easily traverse the everyday. As easy as something like this might seem to explain, the number of missing person cases that we address every year is something that is a little more difficult to explain. Sure, people go missing. Sure, people jump ship so that they can try and escape maybe things that are going on in their lives. People jump ship, so to speak, and they leave their life to find a new life and a new way of living. There are any number of reasons why a person might go off the grid. And then there are people who go missing maybe as a result of kidnappings and things like that. But there are certain other cases that are a little more difficult to explain. We've addressed a few of those in the past on this program. And tonight, Butch Witkowski joins us. I would like to pick his brain about a few of these. Welcome, by the way, for your first time to the program, Butch. How are you?
I'm doing fine, sir. How are you guys doing?
Well, we're doing wonderful, Butch, and I appreciate you so much joining us tonight, because I've been a follower of your work for a long time. You and I have corresponded a bit in the past, but it's truly high time we have you on this show, because this is a subject that I've addressed in the past, but I could ramble on out about it. I'd much rather hear, as I think our listeners would, your perspectives on this. First, let's phrase this question and the problem, I think. What are we looking at when we're talking about, at very least, what we would term the anomalous missing person cases?
Well, if folks would go to NCIC statistics for the FBI, that's the National Crime Information Center. And what got me to them was I was going to give a dissertation on abduction. And although I was familiar with abduction, I really, really, really didn't have a whole lot of information. So about halfway through what I was looking at, I decided to look to see, well, just approximately how many people can be missing at one time, you know. And so I went into the NCIC statistics, which is published every year. And what they are the, it's actually a pile of papers that's sent to every police department, sheriff's department, every law enforcement agency in the United States. And what they do is they fill out the blanks. How many rapes did you have? How many bicycles were stolen? How many banks were robbed, you know, et cetera. But it also has in there about missing persons, and it breaks it down pretty good. So I went back to 2008, because they're always 2 years behind, and then I just brought it up to 2013. So in 2013, there were 896,000 missing persons reports filed. Now, about 95% of those are still found. 75% of the runaways under the age of 18, you know, they just get PO'd at the parents and split. You got about 20% that are spousal abuse, murders, elderly, ransom demands, kidnapping. But the number that sticks out and has since 2008, since I've been watching it, is the 5% that are never found. And that number now is 50,000 rounding off. Going back even further, since 1991, when the process was really started and kept up to date, over 14 million missing persons reports have been filed. So using the same math, 5%, which does not change but a half a percent since I've been looking at it in 2008 up till 2013, about 700,000 people are never found. There's no trace of them ever located. No bodies, no clothing, no whereabouts, no last known address, never seen. And that's men, women, and children. So, you know, when you look at that over 17 years, you're looking at almost 60,000 people a year that are just gone. They're just gone.
Those are staggering numbers, Butch. You know, one thing that I wanted to point out, by the way, and I know that your research, you're a veteran of law enforcement. You've got a lot of background with this, and your research has even influenced maybe the most popular writer on this today, David Pilates, who focuses on national parks. Now, I could understand a person going missing, maybe, for prosaic reasons, we might say, in a national park, but I take it that a lot of these missing person cases that you deal with, they don't necessarily always happen in national parks or wilderness areas. Some of these people, even in well-populated areas, they go missing. I mean, they will, as though they just walk off the face of the earth. Is that the case?
Oh, yeah. We have reports where, I'll give you one, for instance, where a group of young people in their 20s were at a local bar, restaurant for Saturday night. The bar was closing up, so everybody gathered out front, and the one gentleman went and said, "I'll go get the car," and people watched him walk into the parking lot, and then he didn't return. So they went looking for him in the parking lot, which didn't at that point have many cars in. Car was there, but he was never found, ever.
Oh, you know, there was one just the other day in Canada. Did you see this report about the, there was a common law marriage, this gentleman and his wife, she had had a bit of a history of drug use. He had left the car running, keys in the ignition. She was in the passenger seat, walks into the liquor store, comes back out 3 minutes later, Butch.
Yeah.
You saw this case?
Yep.
Do you know, has the woman been found yet? Do you know? I haven't seen this yet.
Oh, no, she hasn't been found yet.
Unbelievable. You know, yet again, her cell phone is still sitting right there in the car. The keys are still in the ignition. The car is undamaged otherwise. Woman.
And there are a lot like that, you know, where somebody is, you know, there was one guy's riding his lawnmower out in his front lawn, says to his wife, he's coming in for a tea. She gets nice tea ready. He never comes in. She goes outside. He's never seen again. Lawnmower's out there. Key ignition is off, sitting there just where it left, and he's gone. No struggle, no clothing, nothing.
This is really strange. I mean, really strange. And to be very brief, Butch, I do want to just share something with you. part of what got me interested in this, my friend, is that I have a distant relative named Claude Calloway, who here in Western North Carolina just a few decades ago, this happened with Claude. Claude had been sitting on the porch. His father had been making sandwiches. And through the open window leading into the house, he had been talking with his dad, and his father had said, Claude, do you want tomatoes on your sandwich? They'd just been having a regular conversation. Claude doesn't answer. And he asks him again, you know, do you want tomatoes or not? Because if you don't want them, I'm going to eat them all. No response. Looks out on the porch. Claude isn't there. Claude is as though he'd walked off of the porch and just off into another dimension. Claude disappeared. He never showed up in another census record. My father, an amateur genealogist, he's traced this story, and no one seems to know where Claude Calloway went. Now, I'll tell you a strange thing, though. There was a photograph taken shortly before his disappearance in which the family photo turned out fine, but Claude's face didn't appear in the photo, as though he had not been there. What could account for these cases where people seemingly vanish into thin air? Butch, what are your opinions about this? I mean, what are the theories? Are there things?
Well, the theories range from interdimensional snatching to government intervention to, of course, our space brethren. Things that we've taken out of the equation altogether have been, you know, people were saying, well, they were being snatched by black mass groups to hold ceremonies and this. Well, that made no sense whatsoever, because none of these cases ever seem to be alike. There's always something different. And there have been a few just recently where, you know, college students have walked off drunk from a party and fell into the lake or fell into a water or this,
sure,
kind of thing. But they eventually find them. But what we're talking about with these cases is they're not found. I mean, there's one case where a guy and his wife are walking their dog, and the dog stops to do his business, and the husband keeps on walking, just goes around a little bend in the road. She comes around, and he's never been found again. So, you know, are they walking into another dimension? Are they being snatched? Even if it was a government thing, you know, there had to be a car. You know, they didn't just walk up and make him disappear. We're talking about people that just vanish. They're just not there anymore. They don't exist. There's no bodies ever found. Like you said, keys and wallets and all this stuff are found in cars. The keys that were in that the guy had in his hand that went to the left the group on the porch and went to get the car for the group. The keys were never found, and no struggle. There's never any struggle. You know, like if somebody was jumped out and grabbed you, you know, there's something happens. Somebody loses a shoe, or there's maybe some blood stains or this, that, and the other thing. But these are just clean. They're just like, it's very hard to explain. It's like turning off a computer or turning off a television set. It just, it's that cut and dry. They're gone, and they're never seen of again and never heard from. And some of the cases where they said, well, these people have been missing for 10 years, but now somebody's been controlling the bank account. And they say, well, that's a kidnapping. That was somebody that took their stuff and is using it and got rid of them. But the ones that are truly amazing are the ones that you just can't get any information on. We're getting more and more information on this stuff happening in Europe. And we have one of our group members is in Europe, in England, and he's a doctor, and he sends us a lot of information, and I'm waiting for some now that, I mean, they mirror the things that are happening here, which we investigate, plus the type of things that David Pleiades investigates. And David's stuff is just as strange as the stuff we run into. I mean, you know, he's got people that walk over, you know, dad's following the son through the woods, and the kid just goes over a little rise, and the kid's gone forever, never found. Now, if it was an attack by an animal, you surely know there'd be a scream, struggle, growling, whatever. There's none of that. The ground isn't disturbed. Some people disappear. Their backpack is laying there, or their walking stick or whatever they had on them is lying on the ground, but they're not there.
So strange. It's so very strange, Butch. I know that you have looked into a lot of human mutilation cases. Before we get into that, however, I do want to ask you. You also have an interest and a background, actually, as a researcher in UFO research. You and I both do, and I think you, Butch, this is something you and I, we've told each other in the past. We both have a mutual attitude toward this unconventional attitude toward UFO research. Do you feel, you know, and I think I ask you this rather than as a radio host to a guest, as I say researcher to researcher, do you feel that there is anything in any way, in your opinion, and when we're recalling your background as a law enforcement officer here, and also your research maybe as an investigative researcher and journalist, do you look at this, and have you ever seen anything that ties what you perceive as being UFO phenomena in with any of these disappearances?
To be honest, I would have to say no. It still boils down to the three that we keep looking at, which is, you know, our space brethren and the interdimensional thing, which has now taken off really big, I guess, in the Bigfoot, the cryptozoology genre, and government cover-ups. I tend to lean more toward the space brethren, but at the same time, it sounds a little silly, I'm kind of tilting with information that is coming from the cryptozoology crowd. I got a case a month ago where a guy's walking his two Weimaraner dogs,
mm-hmm.
big dogs, in a state park here in Pennsylvania. Parks his truck, grabs the dogs, takes them for the walk like he does every day. He's a retired airline pilot. Starts walking up this trail, which is what they call a fire lane, and the dogs are going nuts. And he stops, and he's holding on the dogs. The dogs are tearing at the ground. I mean, they're actually digging a hole trying to get to the right-hand side of the road. And he's as he's trying to calm the dogs and hold them back out of the woods. Now, this creature, I'm going to say creature because I don't know what it is,
sure.
walks out of the woods. It is nothing like a Bigfoot. It is man-like, very muscular. And he said it just walks across, never looks at him or the dogs. Now, these dogs want to rip this whatever it is apart. Never looks at them, never looks at him, and just proceeds across the road and steps up into the other side. His description was, like I said, a very well-built man, short, dark brown or black hair. Didn't have that really high, stiff, cone neck, head that you'd see from Bigfoot representations. And the thing that bothered him was it looked like it had a short snout, like a dog with a short snout, not like a Doberman, but, you know, maybe a bulldog. And so he took the dogs back, got them in the truck, retrieved the pistol, went back up, walked in both sides because he knew exactly where it crossed because he was right there. Nothing. Goes back, tells a couple buddies. They go back the next day. They're armed to the teeth with high-powered rifles. They go in. They walk into the right-hand side where it came walking out of. Nothing. They walk in about 100, 150 yards. They cross over the road. They go on the other side to get in about 50 yards, and they all stop. And they all had the same feeling of, we need to leave right now. And they split. And the guy told me when I talked to him, he said, I will never go back there again, ever. And I asked him what he felt. He said, first word in my mind was terror. Second word, fear. Third word, not good, death. Hmm. And he said, I'm never going back there again. He said, I've hunted in those woods since I was a child. He said, I'm never going back.
Well, that's
talk to some other researchers in the area and see if they ever had anything like that. They related to me that on two cases, they had a gentleman that came along with them, you know, just to do some investigation work. He came running out of woods, white as a ghost, and he's never been back since. And another time, basically the same thing happened, but it was with three members of another group that just left. So, are we dealing with something that's interdimensional, that this whatever it was crossed the road and didn't even know that they were being seen? So they didn't see him, but he saw them. And it's very complicated. And, you know, when you look back at some of the reports, it's happened more than once, and it's happened more than here in Pennsylvania. The government thing, yeah, we have reports of people being snatched out of their cars, but, you know, they're usually returned. And they tell their whole story, then they're kind of made to look like idiots, and everybody blows them off. then the alien thing, that's wide open because, you know, some of the cases, how people have disappeared is just strange. You know, we found, I had a researcher, two archaeologists, researchers, working in England, and they're going through some old church records, and you know, England, they keep records back to day one.
Oh, yeah.
And they're just paging through stuff in this little shire in the church, just looking for information. They're actually trying to find a burial ground of some hierarchy guy, some king, some queen, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But the guy says, we're looking through stuff, and he said, we came across this little, like an article. He said it was like the town notes. And he said that so-and-so was working on in a field and turned up missing, and for a fortnight, nobody could find him, a very well-known member of the church, evidently. And then they did find him up on a roof, and he was naked, had strange holes in his body, and body organs were missing. Well, now you're talking about cattle mutilation, you know? And well, Butch, they found another case.
I was going to say, that sounds to me like a human mutilation, Butch.
Well, it is. But it's, you know, that's what they're telling me. It sounded like a cattle mutilation, and I wrote back and I said, no, that's a human mutilation.
Yeah.
But they found another one of a gentleman up in a tree, and again, gone for approximately the same length of time. Same damage, you know, same missing organs, except this guy's, I believe he said there were four fingers that were missing. Now, they said they would send me what they had. They couldn't take pictures of stuff. That's not allowed because they're afraid the cameras would damage the books. So they said they would send stuff. I've never heard from them again. Their email address has disappeared. Their names I cannot find. My researcher in England can't find anything about them. It's just like they were here, and they don't exist anymore.
Almost as though the researchers actually themselves disappeared. You know, but what's so disconcerting to me is that sounds so similar to something that I think you and I both are familiar with. Butch, when we come back from this break, I want to talk with you about a particular case that sounds so similar to what you're describing. Humans who go missing, or furthermore, humans who are actually mutilated, it's the Gray Alien Report. We'll be right back. Micah Hanks, this is the Gray Alien Report, keeping you company from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time on the KGRA. Be sure and tune in after this for the Richard Dolan program. And those of you out there in the podcast realm, we have thousands every month who download this program out there. And we appreciate all of you who contribute to what we do by listening to the podcast and by downloading it and telling your friends about it just as well. Be sure and help us spread the good word of the Gray Alien. And tell them about the website, www.graylianreport.com, as well as our Twitter account and Facebook. They're both very easy. You type in the URL for Twitter or Facebook, /Graylianreport, and it'll find either of those. Follow us, like us, and help us spread the information, because we're trying to present a rational perspective on all these phenomena that we discuss on this program, as we are discussing tonight with our guest, Butch Witkowski. Now, this is something that is truly disturbing to me, because it seems at times that there are unprecedented cases of missing person incidents which bear highly anomalous characteristics and which yet remain to be explained, at least according to the researchers who advocate the idea that there's something strange going on beyond what can be conventionally explained. Now, Butch, as you were talking about in the last segment, some of these European cases where human beings found puncture holes all over their bodies on a rooftop, it does remind us, you and I especially, of something that we've seen here in the United States, a few incidents that involve human mutilations, and one that comes to mind involves Todd Sees. For those at home who are not familiar with this case, Butch, would you fill us in a little bit and give us the details about this case?
Todd Sees was a resident of Northumberland County, Pennsylvania, the town of Northumberland. He was last seen alive on 4 August of 2002, about 1 o'clock in the morning. His sort of normal routine was to leave the house early in the morning at about 5 o'clock in the morning and drive his ATV up on the mountain, Northumberland Ridge, to spot deer. He was normally back by noon, but this particular day he didn't arrive by noon. And by 2:30, the family called the police and the search party was organized. His body was eventually discovered on 8-5 of 02 at about, 7:54 in the evening. What's strange about the case is almost innumerable. Everything is strange about the case. The guy leaves his house at 5 in the morning. Search party consists of 200 searchers, dogs, state police helicopter, family members who all knew where he went hunting, cadaver dogs, a diver for a pond on the property, and numerous friends, neighbors, and relatives. Northumberland Ridge is about 6 square miles, so there were more than enough people there to cover that area. It was hot. The father was worried mainly about he might have heat stroke or something like that. The ATV was found a mile away from the home. The search continued throughout the day, and nothing. The second day, the search resumed, and nothing till that evening when somebody thought they saw something in the weeds. It's a heavy brush. It's like a bramble brush. And the firemen cut in there, and they find the body of Mr. Sees lying under a downed tree. Now, to get to where they're going for the search party, they have to be walking right past that location. And the condition of the body and the cadaver dogs and search dogs not getting a scent on the body would be just totally unbelievable. We started this case with the notion that whatever we got, we would get in writing from the people that we were dealing with, which included the coroner, police, such. And the mystery was, how did everybody walk by this guy, you know? And the newspaper renderings, which came out in the very beginning, said, well, the body was emaciated, it was pale white, had this look of horror upon its face, all this kind of crazy stuff. And journalistic endeavors, I believe they call that. But the body was not in that shape. The body, to be in the condition it was in, had to be missing for approximately 40 hours plus to get in the condition it was in. It was rendered to be a closed casket because of the shape of the body. He had no internal injuries. He had marks on the body, lots of scrapes, scratches, lacerations. Now I'm going to stop there and bring up the point that that day, the day before rather, a UFO was reported seen above the power lines, which run through and over the top of Northumberland Ridge by two fishermen in the river, which is approximately a mile from that area, and a farmer whose field actually abuts up against that forest land, the ridge. The fishermen say in the report, the UFO report, and Todd Sees was not known at that point, that they had saw, what they saw was it looked like somebody in their underwear being pulled up into a light into the craft, and the craft was hovering over the power lines, and then it took off. Mr. Cease was found in cut-off jeans with no boots and a T-shirt. He went out into the field with a set of camouflaged coveralls. So the case gets weirder because the autopsy says that he died of a cocaine overdose. We got the autopsy report. I think it was given to us by mistake, but we got it, and the toxicology report. And the amount of degraded cocaine in this guy's body, when I checked with forensic doctors here and physicians that deal in that and pathologists, the amount of degraded cocaine in his body, he would have never taken two steps, let alone got back to his house from the ATV, which was exactly a mile away. So either I have the first case of a documented zombie, or somebody is really lying a lot. Then in the autopsy report, it states that the clothing was found. The police said that the clothing was found. They don't say who finds it or who found it, and they say the cocaine was in the pocket. We came later to understand, and also in writing, that the family found the coveralls, and there was nothing in the pockets. From the time the body is picked up at the scene where it's found and to the autopsy at the hospital, there's a 14-hour time span. We don't know where that body was for 14 hours and who had control of the body. Even though the body bag was tagged, they put like a little plastic tag on with a number. Nobody ever checked to see if the numbers were corresponding and in accordance with a log where it'd be, you know, like tag number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Maybe somebody skipped one or made a duplicate. That was never checked and can't be. So it was written off as a cocaine overdose. We found Mr. Cease's quote-unquote criminal record, which was actually a traffic citation 3 years prior in another part of the county for speeding. That's it. He was very big into Little League, talking with some of the people from the Little League, which he was involved in for many years. They said if we would have had a hint that he was even smoking marijuana, he never would have got within a block of these kids. He was an avid outdoorsman, sportsman, drove a bread truck for a living. And then we started to find that he didn't exist. We couldn't find high school records. We couldn't find marriage records. We couldn't find birth of his children's records. We couldn't find anything. Military records. No driver's license in the state of Pennsylvania. And just to show you how that works, I checked my own driver's license to see if it was still on record when I took my test and everything when I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. Still have it. I'm 47. It even gives the name of the trooper that gave me my test. My stuff is there. So I went to the death index, Social Security death index, which when you die, it goes in there. And because they pull your Social Security number, it's no longer available. And in the Social Security index, death index, it lists his date of birth, date of death, marriage, no record found, children, no record found, family, no record found. Last known address, no record found. So I pulled up my father, who died back in 1970. In my father's death index, like many others I looked at, name, date of birth, high school you attended, graduation, military record, wife's name, children's name, children's birth dates, where you worked, where you lived, every address you ever lived at. One even went as far as to give a phone number. And I know it was right because it was my phone number. So, here's a man who everybody seemed to like. I mean, we haven't come across anybody that had a bad word against the guy.
Was he well known in, like, I mean, with regard to his community? I mean, did people, I mean, obviously we know that there was the Little League connection, but was he well known by people in his community? Did he, I mean, was there any indication that he involved himself in social and public activities and things like that?
Yeah, the guy was really well liked. I mean, everybody we talked to, and when I say everybody, we've been able to talk to maybe 10 people. And out of the 10, nobody had a crossword for the guy. Everybody said he was a hard worker, had a nice home, nice family, a large family, brothers, sisters, lots of cousins, nephews, nieces, hard worker, avid sportsman, attended all of the sports events, you know, and was really into the Nuri Little League. And it just doesn't fit the pattern. I mean, we cannot find any previous commitment for drug abuse or anything like that. I mean, somebody that would take that amount of cocaine would surely know that the amount that they were going to take was going to kill them on the spot. So accidental. I mean, you know, he was doing something he did many, many times by going out on his ATV spotting deer. Suicidal. Nothing leads to that. No thing there. No divorce pending. No issues with family or anything like that. But the things that were a little bothering was the coroner did not tell us the truth. He said that he wasn't there to pronounce the body, that it was the other coroner, another coroner. Well, we kind of called him on that because he said, wait a minute, you beat the other guy in the electoral race 2 years prior. So he has retired 2 years ago. You are the coroner. So why would he, who's retired, be the guy to be called to pronounce this guy dead? Well, he yelled around about that. That was the last we heard of him. And then the police, who were saying they were the spokesmen and, you know, we shouldn't be bothering, and they're hiding everything, and it was no case is closed, you know, until we know what's going on. It's an open case. Well, in Pennsylvania, as in other states, the only way a case stays open, that it's never closed, if there is suspicion of a murder or, you know, some type of act. Well, they already had the answer. They had, this guy was, you know, overdosed on cocaine. So then we found out that police department wasn't even handling the case. The case was turned over to the state police. And the state police took it from when he was found until all the way through the autopsy. And one of the things that was kind of strange in the autopsy was that, you know, they took hair samples and fingernail clippings and stuff like that. And that's only taken when there's suspicion of a murder. I mean, an overdose, why would you take somebody's hair clippings and fingernail clippings?
Yeah, exactly. It would seem more conclusive what led to the cause of, or rather, the actual death itself. You know, with regard to this case, Butch, you know, I look at this one and I, like yourself, I see a lot of problems. That's the understatement of the year, really. Then again, it's early in the year. But I would say that, you know, speaking with Peter Davenport, you've spoken with Peter Davenport about this, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And Pete pointed out to me a while back, he said, you know, when inquiring about the actual autopsy records, he had been told that he would never see those, that they would never be released to him. Have you encountered that same issue with regard to this?
No, we weren't. We called the coroner first by phone, and then we sent an email, and then he sent us a return email regarding us giving some kind of donations to a foundation or that he was part of or that he founded for children's research or something. And we sent him back another email saying that well, that's not what we're after. We would really like to see if we could get a copy of the Todd Cease autopsy report and the toxicology report. We didn't hear anything for a few days, and a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sent him another email, and, you know, is it possible to get this? And he said, yes, but it's going to cost you. And he gave us a price, which we paid.
Yeah.
And a couple days later, we got it.
Mm-hmm.
Toxicology and the autopsy report.
Okay.
And, as a matter of fact, I'm sitting here looking right at it. the case now for us is going into year five. This is our fifth year on the case. Still some things that got to be answered to our benefit. I mean, as far as, you know, that we don't have anything, because we've been snowballed on this so many times, not only by law enforcement and district attorney, but the FBI. Fire department said they never even responded to such a call. Now, everybody's familiar with the guy dying and the search team out there, but yet the fire department has no record. in their log of being dispatched to that location on a missing person.
That's weird.
Well, yeah. every time we've used a Freedom of Information Act, we've gotten them back that had on their return because of bad spelling, undetermined grammar, unknown origin. I mean, you name it, we got it. So putting it all together, I mean, it took my little half-inch binder up to a 3.5-inch binder. Our cold case unit that we have here in UFORCOP, which is four guys, really, they've been the ones really working hard. We've gotten a lot of assistance with from Lon Strickler from Phantoms and Monsters.
Mm-hmm.
So we just keep digging and documenting. But it's just a very strange case with so many avenues. I mean, look, if it was going to be a murder, in that, if you'd see that location, I could drive up there in a car, whack you on the head with a hammer, and drive out, and nobody would ever know. I mean, it's just that dense.
Pretty rugged, huh?
Oh, it's just solid wood. I mean, you know, the only clear spot is the clearing for the power lines to go up over the ridge. So if it was something that like that, okay. But look, you got two. Let's just say 200 people out there, plus a helicopter, and family members who knows where he goes. Everybody's yelling, screaming, carrying on. He doesn't hear them. They don't hear him. He shows up in his own backyard, 150 yards from his back door, dead.
Hmm.
No internal injuries. He had no health issues. One of the things that I'm having a blood person look at is autopsies that I've attended in the past. The blood's always taken. Test blood is always taken from the chest cavity because that's where you find the freshest blood.
Right.
In his case, they didn't take anything from the chest cavity because they said there was nothing there, so they took it from his leg. Also, the toxicology was taken from his leg. Very strange. I mean, if they suspected a cocaine overdose, if they suspected that, is why they were doing toxicology, I would imagine. Why wasn't the nose swabbed or the throat swabbed?
So strange.
He had no fractures, no hematomas in the brain. Everything about his autopsy was, with the exception of cocaine, was pretty much unremarkable, with just a few exceptions like the blood and where they drew the blood and stuff like that. But it's, you know, we've been lied to by the family. We've been lied to by pretty much everybody we dealt with few exceptions. And, you know, I'm not saying he was taken by aliens. I'm just saying that, you know, there was a report, a logged report of a sighting. He goes missing, and he's found the next day. He's missing for one full day and found the next day in the evening. And then we have this series of kind of contradictions from everything that was put out in the very beginning. And not all of it was by Peter Davenport. A lot of it was from local papers. And there's another thing. We went into the archives and we had contacted, or one of my guys had contacted the newspaper reporter that broke the original story. And she talked to us, I think once or twice. And then we didn't hear from her. So we went back and thought, my guy thought he better go back in and get those things out of the newspaper archives. They're not there anymore.
Huh.
Fortunately, I grabbed them long ago. When I first started the case, I got all those. But all those that I have are no longer in that newspaper archive.
So you mean the original archives for that newspaper that carried this story are no longer publicly accessible? Is that right?
Yeah.
But that you have,
couldn't find them.
But that you have the copies of those articles.
Yes.
That is so bizarre.
From back when I got those copies right after I read Peter Davenport's report. Because her name was there, the paper she worked for and all that, so I just went in there and kept watching it, and as every story came up, I copied it. So I have it in my computer, and I have it on paper.
Huh. Well, that is really strange. But, you know, if you had to... Actually, I will not ask you to speculate about this at this time, but I would ask you this. If there's any significant lead, anything about this case that seems to indicate to you one direction that would be promising about anything that you've found, is there any singular piece of evidence that you would cite right now that would be most fruitful?
I would say that there was an abduction taking place.
When you say an abduction, are we talking about...
From the craft that was above the power lines.
Okay. Now, and my final question about that, Butch, would be the fact that there's so little information available about the background of Mr. Cease with regard to his education, his family, all of this. Do you think that in any way that that has anything to do with the disappearance?
Yeah. There's only one group of people that can make you disappear on paper.
What group is that?
Same guys who pay our taxes to.
Boy, I tell you, such disturbing stuff. I tell you, this is one of those nights, guys, where the rabbit hole just gets deeper and darker and deeper and darker. And Butch, I certainly want to thank you. You know, I could talk with you for hours about this. Unfortunately, the clock will not allow for that. Maybe I would sincerely hope that we can get you back on sometime because there's so much more we could dig into. My mind is my head is swimming right now with the different possibilities in relation to this one case, and it's only one of many. Where can folks find out more about what you do and how you do it, and of course, where they can find you online?
Well, excuse me, I'm starting to get a bit of a cold here. They can find us online at the our website, which is www.uforcop. That's the website address, and on there they can just scroll down and they can get into the archives of cases that we've completed. They can go into the blog. We publish JAR Magazine, which is a journal for abnormal abduction research. They can view our resources list. They can see some stuff on Todd Cease. They can see the rendering that was sent to me by the gentleman, the creature that walked out across the road. Pictures of photographs of stuff that have been taken here in Pennsylvania. Contact list for any one of our 12 groups. We have groups in England, in Poland, and the United States, in Utah, Oklahoma, Northern California, Michigan, Missouri, Georgia, Northeast Florida, Florida, Central Florida, and here in Pennsylvania. We have our own mobile units. If you're in Pennsylvania, we can get to any place in Pennsylvania within anywhere from 2 to 5 hours from one end to the other. And fully equipped, we have two of those. Carry everything from satellite communication, sat phones, and everything we need, infrared cameras, movie cameras, video cams. So we're pretty much ready to rock and roll whenever we're needed. And we will be having a coming up April 18th, I have to throw this plug in here or somebody will kill me.
Please do.
We're going to have, for the first time I'm aware of, in the state of Pennsylvania, we're going to have a paranormal roundtable. It's going to be held up in Albertus, Pennsylvania, at the Albertus Community Center. It's going to be a roundtable discussion, not a conference. It's going to be on ghosts, paranormal, cryptozoology, UFOs, and all cases of high strangeness that we encountered here in PA. And it's audience participation. It's an open forum. We'll have Ghost Hunters, Inc. there from Pennsylvania. They've been incorporated since 72. The Keystone Bigfoot Project, Legend Hunters, Phantoms and Monsters will be there with the Fortean Research Group, and we'll be there. Tickets are reasonable. They're like $15, $20 at the door, $15 if you go online. And they can get to that on our website or on our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page, too, just U4COP. And should be a good time, answer a lot of questions. We'll take reports, and people can ask what we do, how we do it, what we found, what we used to find it, and what's right, what's wrong, and what's not so hot.
Wow, I tell you, that fascinating stuff. I hope people in your area can check that out. Butch, I want to thank you again for coming on the Gray Alien Report. Got to get you back on at some point, and if I'm up Pennsylvania way anytime soon, I'm going to hit you up. Hopefully we can catch up for a cup of coffee, too, okay, my man?
Absolutely.
Really, true.
Heading down your way for the Brown Mountain Light shortly.
You know, if you're in this area, Butch, you know how to reach me, so hit me up, okay? I'd love to catch up with you and talk. We'll compare notes, and again, in the future, we will have you back on the Gray Alien Report. And Butch, again, finally, thank you so much. Short notice today, you jumped on with us and, you know, addressing all these stories, the relevant things in the news, and also things that have a broader implication, I think, like this case. Keep up the good work out there, my friend, okay?
Thank you, Micah. Take care now.
Yeah, absolutely. Butch Witkowski, ladies and gentlemen, we'll have his information linked up there in the show notes. The missing person case. I mean, this is something that has long fascinated me, and I think it's just as equally unsettling for most of us who study this phenomenon. I know the guys here in the bunker and I, we have held a long interest in this. And no doubt we will continue to just as well, whether it be young children who go missing in the Great Smoky Mountains or men with, well, apparently no verifiable record and no history of substance abuse who are found scantily clad and, of course, with bodies full of illegal substances. Very unsettling stuff. The kinds of things that from time to time we have to delve into on this program. It is the Grayling Report. We examine mysteries, we examine science, and we look for answers. I'm Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, and of course Race and Robin Hobbs, we bid you adieu, my friends. Check us out online at www.graylingreport.com, as well as on Twitter and on Facebook. And in the meantime, until we speak with you next time, subscribers a little sooner, but the rest of you guys out there, stay strange. We'll catch you very soon.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, graylianreport.com.